I don't know if the name Thomas Boston means anything to you. Thomas Boston was a Scottish divine. They called him a Scottish theologian, a pastor theologian in the early 18th century. So a few years after the Civil War, he and his wife had 10 children, and they had to witness the death of 6 of them, most of those in infancy. He was the Church of Scotland minister of the little village of Ettrick in the Scottish borders. It's about 1,000 feet up, so it's cold in winter, and you can imagine the primitive conditions that people lived in those days. Imagine what it would be like if your child as a baby or an infant got a cold and couldn't shake it off, and they witnessed 6 of their children die in those circumstances. And struggling to come to terms with that tragedy, he wrote a short pastoral book. He preached a sermon on Ecclesiastes 7:13. Consider the work of God, who can make straight what he has made crooked. And if you like, you might like to have that verse up on the screen, because I'm going to spend quite a bit of time on it. Consider the work of God, who can make straight what he has made crooked. And out of that, he produced a book called The Crook in the Lot. And it became a classic. It's sort of a sermon expanded into a little book, and it sold all over Scotland. And across the world, and it's still selling today. I bought my copy in Dunstable Bookshop, can you believe? There you go. I happened to be here and saw it and thought, right, I'll take that and pay for it. Thomas Boston talks about a crook. And what does he mean? He doesn't mean a shepherd's crook. He doesn't mean a criminal crook. It's either a weaving metaphor or a carpentry metaphor. So in weaving, the threads go into the loom, and they come off the reel, and they go through various rings, and at various times they will bulk up into a blob of thread. I was once a salesman in the rag trade, and we call it a slub. That's the technical name for it. It's not a very nice name, is it? But slub fabric is actually quite chic in certain kinds of curtains. I believe it or not, and people will buy a fabric that has slubs at regular intervals, making a pattern in the, well, you know, making an effect in the fabric to make your sort of, well, it's a bit 1970s to be honest, but it was big in the 1970s. So you have a slub in the factory, in the fabric, a blob on a thread that bulks up, and of course it distorts the rest of the fabric. Or you cut up a tree trunk into planks, to use the carpentry metaphor, and of course there's a knot in the wood. And so when you cut your plank, the knot twists with time as the wood dries out and it curves. There is a crook, a crookedness in the wood. And what is crooked cannot be made straight. That's the point of what the preacher or the sage, the wise man of Ecclesiastes is saying. And that's what Thomas Boston was wrestling with in his mind as he reflected on Ecclesiastes 7:13. And it's a huge thing for us to reflect on, isn't it? Why do our lives work out the way that they have? You know, some of those that I'm working with in Didcot have this, you know, why did they go through all the trauma that they did? Why did they put their family through all the trauma that they did? Why does God allow cancer to come into our lives, and heart disease, and diabetes? Why did God take my friend Edward away in a sporting accident, just like that, gone in a day? Why did God allow a missionary lady in Rome to be killed in a road accident? Why does God allow these things to happen? More than that, when we encounter the crooks of life, with all their pain and their tragedy and their trauma and their disappointment, what do our hearts and minds do to process that? That's the really big issue, isn't it? How do we handle those times? Do we take the grief and the frustration and just keep turning it over and over in our mind like beads on a rosary, you know, going over all the details as though somehow we could go back and change it and it would all be different? Or do we look for wisdom, for biblical wisdom? See, the book of Ecclesiastes is about a search, a journey towards wisdom. So think about these powerful words. Consider the work of God, who can make straight what he has made crooked. Take that first phrase, first of all. Consider the work of God. What we mean by the work of God is the work of God in his sovereign ruling of providence. Don't be intimidated by the word providence. It comes from the verb to provide. And it is really what God has provided for us in all the outworking of his provision in the events of everyday life. If we believe that God is sovereign over everything that happens, then we receive everything as something he has provided for us, for good or ill, for joy or sorrow. God is a good and a kind creator. And when he made everything, he looked at all that he had made, and behold, it was very good. All was straight. Nothing was crooked. But Adam and Eve rebelled against God, and they thought that they knew better than God. That's always the source of all our problems, isn't it? And so every kind of evil and rebellion entered the world. And not only that, as a consequence, Genesis 3 records God bringing a curse on the human race, without exception, on all of us. But when God placed a curse on his creation, he didn't just do that and then walk away, totally withdrawing his grace from us. No, he remains the wise ruler of creation. His common grace allows good things still to happen to everyone, to the couple walking the baby walker down the road. They've got a newborn baby in there, and they don't go anywhere near a church, but they're rejoicing in their new baby. Well, that's God's common grace, isn't it? Young couple walk down by the river in Luton. Do you have a river in Luton? Is there anywhere romantic to go for a walk? No, they go up on the downs, all right, and they fall in love, and they look in each other's eyes, and it's an amazing feeling. Neither of them have ever prayed in their life, but there is something going on, and it's amazing. I can see a couple right now walking hand in hand across the road out there. Perfect example. No idea whether they go anywhere near a church, but God, by his common grace, gives them joy. Yeah? They know what it is to be in love. God is in charge of all that, and he's in charge of every patient at the Luton and Dunstable Hospital. He knew the day when my dad was going to die there, when he was aged 92. And we call that rule his providence, his providing. Ephesians 1 verse 11 says he works all things, there is no exception to that, he works all things according to the counsel of his will. All things. Nothing happens in life outside of God's control where he's just wringing his hands and saying, I'm very sorry, but that's nothing to do with me. No, he works out all things according to the counsel of his will. Everything he brings into our lives has some mysterious purpose that is most often hidden from us. He disciplines those he loves. He refines us in the trials of life. Hebrews 12, for the moment all discipline seems painful rather than pleasant, but later it yields the peaceable fruit of righteousness to those who have been trained by it. And the writer of Ecclesiastes, whoever he was, says, it is the work of God that leaves some things straight so that some people sail through life with very few troubles, and other things are crooked and will never straighten them out. Now here's the hard lesson to learn, and it's very painful. We will never straighten out what God has made crooked. Who can make straight what God has made crooked? However much I think I could straighten out all these problems, if I was allowed to do it, I will never manage it. God has put that crook there, that crookedness there, that annoying circumstance, that disability, that traumatic memory, that daily pain, that inescapable grief. And no matter how we try to change that, we will fail. I had a friend in Scotland when I was training for ministry, and she had permanent neurological pain. She wrote a book. Her name is Irene Howard. I don't know if you've ever come across her books. She wrote a book called Pain, My Companion. Some of us joked that she was talking about her husband, but he was one of the staff in the college. It's very beautiful and powerful to see how she's learnt to accept that she's going to be in pain all her life and she can't change that. And God has given her a wonderful writing ministry. You may have encountered some of her books for children as well as for adults. There are things that we cannot change. We wish we could undo our past behavior. You know, Jess and Bob, her husband, and Jenny and Ricky would love to undo all the lunacy of teenage addiction, but they can't. We wish we could have cemented that relationship, but we ruined it, and it's broken, and it's gone. And now we're alone. Why have we been born in a body that does not behave as other people's healthy bodies behave? Why are we continually passed over for promotion at work and the people who get the job are patently not up to it when we think we could do it? We try and go back and relive that life-changing accident, that tragic accident. If only I hadn't turned left at that point, if only I hadn't run out. And you just turn it over and over in your mind. You cannot straighten out that crookedness. We cannot change the past. We cannot straighten out what God has made crooked. And there's a key spiritual lesson here, and this is this. Will we surrender to the will of God? Will we surrender to the will of God? Will we let God be God in our lives? We must submit to the truth that God has a plan for each of our lives and he is fashioning something different in each one of us. Some of us he wants to live to 92, like my dad. Lived in Luton and died in the Luton and Dunstable at the great age of 92. I have no idea that I shall live as long as him. My friend Edward, who died in a sporting accident, he was taken away in his 40s. Why does God allow some people to live long and others to be taken away? A little boy I was at school with when I was 12 was murdered. Why did he not live and I did? We must trust God that in his plan, he is all wise, and that his plan is the plan of an eternally loving God. That is really important to stress. He is not a nasty tyrant. He is an eternally loving God. Now, the book of Ecclesiastes is about seeking wisdom to try and understand life when it is incomprehensible. And the book of Ecclesiastes, like the book of Proverbs, tells us that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. So the battle that goes on in my heart every day is this. Am I going to be guided by my own wisdom, which I think is so clever, or am I going to be surrendered to God's wisdom? Now you might say in reply, well, if you want wisdom, why on earth would you go and look for it in the book of Ecclesiastes? It is so depressing. One of my minister friends said to me, Jim, the good news is about the book of Ecclesiastes, you don't have to preach on it. And for many years, I kind of believed that because I avoided it. And then the pandemic came along and I preached on it, preached through it in the first lockdown. And it just came alive to me. People say this is a book written by someone who has lost sight of God. He's lost his faith and he's just pouring out his woe. No, I don't believe that. I think this is a book about someone who is pursuing wisdom. He won't find it ultimately until we find Jesus, in whom are found all the riches of wisdom and knowledge. But the book takes us there in various forms. And what you have to understand is there are sort of different passages in the book of Ecclesiastes. There are observations on life. I saw under the sun. And mostly those are dismal and despairing. So chapter 1, verse 14, I have seen everything that is done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and a striving after wind. That word vanity is hard to translate. Vanity and meaningless are the translations we usually have. What it actually means is temporary. Everything is temporary. Everything is passing. Or put it another way, everything is vaporous. You know, I breathe in on a cold day and then I breathe out and there's my breath in the air and then the wind takes it away. That's life. It's like a vapor and it's gone. That's his observation. So he observes the brevity of life. And all the good and wonderful things we do as gifts from God are suddenly taken away. Even the best things we do are quickly gone, and we are quickly gone, and we are forgotten. So there are observations on life. That's the first thing. When you see a passage where it says, so for example, chapter 6, verse 1, there is an evil that I have seen under the sun, and it lays heavy on mankind. Well, he is seeing the evils of the world, and he is observing them from a human point of view under the sun. That is, without reference to God. But then there are other passages of instruction. For example, chapter 5, verse 1. Guard your steps when you go to the house of God. Well, clearly, God is real and he's speaking about him. And he talks about under heaven. And God is very, very sort of subtly introduced into the book as we pass through it. Remember your Creator in the days of your youth, says chapter 12. And there are lots of other instruction passages like that on the way through. They're much more optimistic. And then, thirdly, you get the Proverbs. As well as the observations and the instructions, the observations are gloomy, the instructions are positive, you also get the Proverbs, which are even higher in the ranking, as it were. Here that the preacher's voice is especially confident. This is gathered wisdom. And that's what we have here in chapter 7, set out in Proverbs, as you can see. Now, I'm going to go back to the beginning of the chapter. So if you want to get verse 1 up on the screen, that would be helpful. I think the key to this list of Proverbs is reading the last one first, which is why we went to verse 13. If we can grasp that great principle, consider the work of God, who can make straight what he has made crooked. Now let's come to think about two things. First of all, think about eternity in the house of mourning. Think about eternity in the house of mourning. Verse 1, a good name is better than precious ointment, and the day of death than the day of birth. It is better to go to the house of mourning than to go to the house of feasting. For this is the end of all mankind, and the living will lay it to heart. We love to hear the news of a new baby being born, don't we? We've had two new babies in Didcot. And at Christmas, our daughter told us that she and her husband are hoping to bring us our first grandchild. So we're very excited about that in July. You know, we're looking forward to being grandparents. Yesterday, we were at a wedding in Abbey Baptist Church. Paul Brumming from GBM, his son, was getting married to a girl from Hanny. They looked utterly stunning. The sun had been cloudy and rainy before they got to church, and when they got to church, the sun came through the windows, and it just looked amazing. Oh, to be a third of my age all over again. You know, there's just utter happiness. You know, people were allowed to throw confetti off the church balcony as they walked out. And it was just a lovely, joyful moment. Yeah, it was wonderful. Wow, amazing. But it's better to go to the house of mourning, because there you will do some solemn, wise reflecting on life and what it is for. You see, we may not all have a wedding. Not everybody gets married. And those who do, sometimes it tragically ends in a breakup, doesn't it? Or it ends in bereavement. Both my grandfathers died before my parents were much older than toddlers. So my grandmothers had to live as single parents. We may not all be blessed with children. Many have to struggle with childlessness. But here's the thing, we will all go to a funeral. And we will all one day have a funeral. And it's a time when the living can stop and reflect on the short breath that is this lifespan and lay all these things to heart. Now, that is I've just said a terrible thing, haven't I, in our culture. Nobody wants to talk about death. They've written God out of the story, so for them, life is all there is. So when somebody dies, they're looking backwards the whole way, aren't they? And we've got to turn it into a party. Everybody wear bright colours to a funeral, they'll say. Don't anybody wear black. Why? Don't we want to mourn? Doesn't death make us shout out at the horror of death, even as it made Jesus cry at the tomb of Lazarus, who he knew he was going to raise from the dead? We have all these euphemisms, don't we? Passed away, passed on, shuffled off this mortal coil, that's the Shakespeare one, gone to a better place, no longer with us. But we don't use the D word, death. Because if you live your life without God, you are not ready to meet him, are you? And yet that is exactly what will happen to us when we die. What are people going to say to you and about you at the end of your life? It's true that a good name is better than precious ointment. That's a very, you know, to have a good name at the end of your life is good. Those who've served well, those who've done their job well, gained a reputation for humility and good character, will be well spoken of at their funeral. But a good eulogy doesn't get you into heaven. A genuinely Christian funeral is different. It's a place of hope, where death is not the end of the story. It should be a gathering where we talk about the work of God in someone's life. I had the joy of watching the Thanksgiving service, the memorial service for Tim Keller in New York. He planned the whole thing while he was dying of cancer, and he insisted that all the tributes in the service, including his own children and his wife, were all talking about what God had done through them. So he had people who had been saved in the various places he'd been in ministry, and they gave a testimony of how they came to know the gospel through him. What a wonderful way to spend a funeral service. And it was filled with hope. Death is not the end of the story. And the focus is not on what this person has done in this life, but what God has done in their life and how he has prepared them for the next life. Do you have any good news in your life? Will it last? Yeah, we have lots of good news. But the only lasting news is that Jesus is our Redeemer, who has come to pay the price to set us free. And God, by his great favor, sent his Son to pay the price of our sin, to clear the guilt that we could not pay. And by dying in his place, we do not have to face the dreadful prospect of hell. Imagine spending your life ignoring God, denying that God exists, and then face the judgment seat of Christ, the worst surprise of your life, having ignored him for all your life. I know someone who lives very near me for whom that must have happened. Told me when I first met him and told him I was a minister, we don't do religion. And he was taken away by a brain tumor in just a few weeks. Several years after that conversation. That's just a journey from there into unending darkness and the absence of God. And it will be horrible. How do you deal with that prospect? Well, the preacher says you can make a joke out of it. Lots of people do, don't they? Someone said on Bob and Paul's TV program Gone Fishing, they chatted to a vicar about what happens when we die. And she said, hell is an idea that medieval men invented to increase their power over people. Has she never read the words of Jesus? It was Jesus who talked about hell, wasn't it? So they say, well, when it's a funeral, have a laugh, have a song. Always look on the bright side of life. Keep laughing and inconvenient truths will fade away. But look at verse 3. Sorrow is better than laughter, for
For by sadness of face the heart is made glad. Verse 4, the heart of the wise is in the house of mourning, but the heart of fools is in the house of mirth. It is better for a man to hear the rebuke of the wise than to hear the song of fools. For as the crackling of thorns under a pot, so is the laughter of the fools. This also is vanity or vapor, temporary. And there's a little sarcastic play on words in there about the crackling of thorns. It doesn't really come out in English, but let me try and put it this way. Listen to the dried out briar burning away in the crackling fire. So the thorns and the pot. It's this kind of play on words going on there. Dry thorns make a lot of noise when they burn. Don't know if you've ever done that. Have you dug up couch grass and dried out the roots and tried burning them? They make a lot of noise when they burn, crackling and popping, and very little heat. It's a bit the same with jokes at a funeral. They don't really work, do they? But you will find a heart of wisdom at a gospel funeral, and by sadness of face the heart is made glad. You will be glad to be thinking about eternity, because it brings us back to the great principle. Consider the work of God. We are sinners in the hands of a holy God, so we need his redeeming grace. So let us be serious about eternity. Let's contemplate eternity in the house of mourning. That's the first thing to say. Secondly, think about time with a calm mind. Think about time with a calm mind. Now, if you look at verses 7 to 12, it can seem like a bit of a ragbag of Proverbs, just all thrown together, disconnected saying. But I think that the common factor between all these Proverbs is that they concern our moods, our mental health, to use the current phrase. If we fret about the way that our lives have turned out, our minds will fall into the traps of self-pity and escapism or anxiety and fear. So here are some wise words about the thoughts that inhabit our minds. Verse 7, surely oppression drives the wise into madness and a bribe corrupts the heart. Now this, since I first preached on this back in 2020, so much has changed. To fulfill this verse more and more. We see other people in power and they make us mad, yeah? select your politician at will, you'll find that all of them have done that. What a time to be a politician. Oppression drives the wise into madness. It obsesses us. We've got to fight against it. We've got to give everything we can to fighting this. And the fight consumes us and it eats up all our energy and it becomes the be-all and the end-all of our life and we can't think about anything else. We go on social media and we pour out our bile to everybody else and feel better about it, but actually we've made everybody else worse as well. On the other hand, if there are corrupt people in power and we allow them to buy us off, what does the second half of the verse say? A bribe corrupts the heart. We can't live at peace with the compromise, can we? If we learn that there are things in life that God has made crooked for us to try us, what will oppression do? It won't drive us into madness, it will drive us to God. That's the point, isn't it? We will not fret about evil men. Taking the advice of Psalm 37, because we know that they and we will one day answer to God. So therefore, think about time with a calm mind. Verse 8, better is the end of a thing than its beginning, and the patient in spirit is better than the proud in spirit. Have you ever realized that pride is a really destructive mood to allow yourself to get into? I mean, pride does so much damage, doesn't it? And it has spoiled so many things in my own heart and in my own life. The destructive pride that says, excuse me, the destructive pride that says, I must get my way at all costs. I know best. It will be done my way or it's the highway, sort of thing. And the time to get it done is now. So come on, let's get it done. We try and straighten out everything that is crooked and we can't. But if we come and learn to be patient in spirit, the patient in spirit is better than the proud in spirit. If we recognize we don't know the end of the story and we are depending on God to lead us and give us wisdom to find our way to the end of the story, life will be very different. If we wait upon the Lord, he will renew our strength. That's the promise of Isaiah 40, isn't it? And we will see his work through to its end in his strength and in his time. In your mind, what are you doing? Are you feeding your pride? Or are you developing your patience? Better is the end of the thing than its beginning, and the patient in spirit is better than the proud in spirit. Third proverb, verse 9. Be not quick in your spirit to become angry, for anger lodges in the bosom of fools. Now, I speak as someone who has struggled with depression in my time as a pastor. In my early years as a pastor, I got burnt out. A number of pastors generally do in their early years. You can find a book in the bookshop called The Pastor with a Thorn in His Side, Pastors Who Struggle with Their Mental Health, and I've contributed a chapter to that. Sorry, shameless book plug. That's terrible, isn't it? But there you go. You can read the story and read other people's stories. Derek French and Steve Neal and others. I thought, having gone through that sort of trough of depression back in 1999 and had to learn to live with that in subsequent years, I thought that the real danger was low mood. But what I discovered a few years later in another situation is that there's a danger as big as gloomy depression. And that is that you have a long rest. I had a sabbatical and I had 3 months without stress. It was wonderful. When I came back, I was on a high, and then my anger caused so much damage. Anger is a really dangerous thing. We can allow ourselves to become manically angry, where our temper gets out of control and we shout at everybody and we have no self-control. And the patience in our spirit is gone. Be not quick in your spirit to become angry, for anger lodges in the bosom of fools. It goes into our hearts and it stays there. And where it lodges, it burns and does lasting damage. You know, anger is like one of those peat fires up on the moors in Yorkshire, isn't it? It keeps burning under the surface. You think you've put it out and it suddenly, you know, it flares up again. Beware of the danger of anger. Verse 10, say not, why were the former days better than these? I seem to have said a lot about the former days today, don't I? I'm very nostalgic in my old age. Why were the former days better than these? For it is not from wisdom that you ask this. Do you know what nostalgia is? It's a sign of being deeply dissatisfied with the present. Being deeply unsatisfied with your lot. It is always a mistake to try and escape by dreaming of this gilded past age. You will not find wisdom living that way. God did not choose you to be born as a Victorian. If he had, he would have had you born in the 19th century, all right? You were born to live in the 20th, in my case, in the 20th century and 21st. Maybe you were born in the 21st century. I don't know. This is the century we are called to live in. God put you here to serve him in the troubles of this present time, and we are people of hope. We believe in sanctification. We believe that the future is bright by God's grace and that he has a great glory coming for us. So do not say, why were the former days better than this? You won't find wisdom if you ask that. Then verses 11 and 12 are not so easy to translate. Wisdom is good with or as an inheritance, an advantage to those who see the sun. For the protection of wisdom is like the protection of money, and the advantage of knowledge is that wisdom preserves the life of him who has it. Is wisdom just something you can buy? No, that's not what it's saying.
If you have money in your pocket, you don't worry, do you? Imagine what it's like, and as many people don't have to imagine at the moment, how are they going to pay their bills? They have no assets to fall back on. They have nothing to pay their debts. It's a horrible situation to find yourself in, and inevitably it produces worry, doesn't it? And what the preacher is saying is, the protection of wisdom is like having assets to fall back on. But your asset is not money, it is wisdom. You have grown in biblical wisdom, and that's the asset that you fall back on in tough times. Our society says, if you've got money, you're all right. And that's not me, is it? Our society says, if you've got money, you're all right. You can fall back on your money, and that's fine. Well, that's not actually, because you can have money and be a complete fool. But the preacher says, what you need is wisdom. Wisdom means being submitted to the will of a sovereign God. Wisdom means being set on eternal life as your inheritance and knowing that nothing can take that away from you. Therefore, you have peace and hope and patience. Live your life under God. Consider the work of God and submit yourself to it. So, think about eternity in the house of mourning and learn the lessons that you learn there, because that will teach you much about life and how short it is. And then think about time with a calm mind, with patience, with wisdom, with godliness, with trust in God. Let's draw this all together. In many ways, verse 14 draws it all together. In the day of prosperity, be joyful, and in the day of adversity, consider. God has made the one as well as the other, so that man may not find out anything that will be after him. It was a lovely day like today, a summer's day, an August day in 2019, when I put on my suit and walked my daughter down Abbey Close, Abingdon, to her wedding. It's a lovely day. We packed 130 people into Abbey Chapel, which is about the same size as this, without the side balconies, and we were absolutely heaving in there. It was a hot day. We were all packed in tight. And you know what it's like at weddings? Everybody hugs each other, don't they? Isn't it amazing? What a lovely, wonderful, happy day. Still got the photo of them walking through the confetti down Chequer Walk. And the sun shone all day, and we went off to a village hall, and the cricket field had a gorgeous sunset on it after the meal. It was just the perfect day. What we didn't know was the global pandemic was brewing. And about 6 months later, nobody would be hugging anybody else. We couldn't imagine how we could have had that day when suddenly here we are, not even allowed to come to church and sort of having to go to the supermarkets in shifts. God made the one as well as the other. That's what it says here in verse 14, isn't it? So that man may not find out anything that will be after him. We don't know what is coming for us this week, do we? I don't. You don't. God does. Therefore, consider the ways of God. Consider the work of God. Who can make straight what he has made crooked?